Mrs. Carpenter, who lives right behind me, Mrs. Craigslamer, and the woman, she has one daughter, who's one of the counselors at Reisenstein, and two daughters who have been in the mayor's office and they're now in the county office, and two sons who have college educations. Well, when she was a little girl, she lived on Blackadar Avenue, and the Depression was on, and they couldn't even afford gas. So they were using oil lamps, you see, and I was their family doctor. Well, when she moved here in this neighborhood, my pussy willow tree has been pushed over into her yard because my gardener has planted too much hyacantha. And as the tree grew, it had to have roots, and it's over in her yard. So I called on her, and I said, I'm Mrs. Grimmerman, who's in front of you, or behind you, whichever way you want to put it. Do you mind my pussy willow tree in your yard? And she says, no, not at all. I said, well, be free to cut it because, you know, it's no longer mine. I have lost it by its growing over in your yard. And she said, would you like to see my home? And I said, I'd love to. And she talked about her family. And then she looked at me and she says, oh, you look just like my Dr. Marks.
Isn't that strange?
And I said, I am your Dr. Marks, dear.
She must have been so surprised.
Yes. She said, oh. And she says, you knew us when we lived on Blackadar Avenue and we were burning oil in a lamp because we couldn't afford gas. I said, that's all right. Mm-hmm. I enjoy taking care of you. And she said, this is so funny. Mm-hmm. Well, one day some boys were climbing over the fence and they were doing things in my yard. And first thing I noticed, Mrs. Carpenter was walking into the next woman's yard. And that woman is a officer at Juvenile Court, commissioned officer. She said that the grandmother came out and called the boys in. And they gave me a lot of sass, these boys, and I had asked them not to. So that evening, the mother called me, Mrs. Verdun, and she said to me, I want to talk to you. And I said, fine. And she said to me, I don't permit my boys to act like they did today. I said, that's all right. And then I said, your boys didn't do anything. They said, yes, they did. They told us they acted you. And she said, Mrs. Carpenter told you who you are. Now, you see, I'm just telling you how one by one, their reserve broke down. Well, they took a halfway house in this neighborhood, and we all got scared. The white people who had stayed in the neighborhood, and most of them who moved out, are all older people. Those who have been forced to stay are mostly Catholic, which means they have paid for two educations, the parochial school as well as the public school taxes. They own their homes. They are retired. If they had to buy a new home now, they couldn't because they're living on Social Security plus all of their monies that they have. Many of them have rented out rooms so they can meet their expenses. So I got up at this meeting, and Judge Tumulty was there, which was a very big meeting, and Councilman Caligari was there. And I pleaded for these people. And somebody said, the neighborhood's gone down. And I said, I don't like you talking that way. They're much better than the shanty Irish and the drunken Saturday nighters who've moved out. This is a respectable neighborhood, and don't you let the blockbusters ruin us.
So what was the result?
Well, the black women went to the mayor. Well, they said we had to take it. It was done by the state. They went to the mayor, and they talked. And then they talked to Judge Tumulty. And they finally promised that after the school year is over, they will move these boys into another neighborhood. But the other night, the doorbell rings, and there's a very intelligent white man at the door. lifted up Mr. Fermilar. He was partially undressed. And when he heard me talk to this man, he came downstairs and said to me, see, his threshold of irritation is very, very low. See, but he's a sick old man. And he says, how's it all on him? And I was pleading with this young man that the mayor and the judge had lied to us, that these boys are not an asset to the neighborhood. That all children brag. I did when I was a child. And when they won't do anything because they know they would be sent to back to prison if they were caught. But they can tell who lives in the neighborhood. And what I fear is that some of their friends that they meet in school will come in and case a joint and take what hurt us. I'm not talking material things. And I said, that's why I don't want you in this neighborhood. I said, that's my husband comes down. Shut the door. Now, I was next door. That's Mrs. Evans calling on her one day when two black women came in. Mrs. Evans is black. She runs a nursery school. She is a licensed faculty nurse, and she has a license to run a nursery school. She takes only 5 children. So, both these women came in and wanted to know which way I lived. And so they didn't know me. And she told them. And then they said, oh, you're the woman that got up at the meeting to about that halfway house. And I said, yes, I'm that woman. So I said, you'll see more of me when the summer comes because I love the garden and I'm always out weeding or cultivating. So then, you see, they had just moved into the neighborhood. We are going to stay.
Right.
Where do you live?
Oh, I'll tell you later about that. This tape is for you. Tell me now, at what point, when did you get married?
22 years ago. Uh-huh. It'll be 23 years.
How did you meet Mr. Fryman?
Marcia is Bob Fullerman's second wife. His first wife was my niece, my brother's daughter, who died with Hodgkin's disease about a year and a half after they were married. I met Mr. Fullerman at Bob and Lois's marriage. And then Mrs. Fullerman, that's Goldie, I met her also then. She died just 4 weeks before Lois died. And 4 weeks after that, Mr. Fermilar's brother lands in the Mullinger Hospital in Rochester as an emergency for Dr. Shug. Mr. Fermilar had gone to the Marxes to tell his son what had happened. And the son was at night school. He was working towards his master's degree in chemistry and working in the daytime. So Mr. Fermilar didn't know where else to go. He was so upset. It was 3 things at once. So he came out to my office. And when he told me what was up, I said, will you go down to Webster Hall and get a room? You're going to stay until after that surgery's over, and maybe you'll spend the night in Pittsburgh. When I'm through my office, I will come down and sit with you. Mm-hmm. Well, we got through the night that Dr. Shook didn't get through operating. It was very big and big. Stricture of the lower bowel. Mm-hmm. It was a very big operation. And about 10:30, he came and told him. And after we got nurses on the case, and I'm sure that David was in as safe hands as possible, I took a cab and came home and left Mr. Fullerman off at Webster Hall. About 3 months after that, I went down there with some of my, with the Gordons who lived, Gibsons who lived in this neighborhood, and Mr. Mr. Perlman is a pianist. Mr. Perlman is very good musician. I've showed you his library of everything he was at a store. Mm-hmm. And at the end of mission, he came and sat next to me, and he says, I'll take you home. And I said, you can't take me home. The Gibsons brought me. The Gibsons are taking me home. I'm very glad that you are here. So when the next doctor came, he calls me ahead, and he says, don't make arrangements to go to the Gibsons. I'm coming after you. And so that's how.
And you continued to practice medicine after your marriage, too.
Oh, yes.
You were known mainly as Pauline Morris.
Yes, well, that's because people didn't know the name of her name.
Yes. Were you ever in, did you ever have a practice with other doctors?
No.
You were?
No.
So just, okay.
Now, you wanted to know about the doctors entertaining each other?
Yes, you could tell us about that.
Yes, well, they have to. I mean, that's part of the hospital agreement. I didn't have to.
Because you got referrals in other ways.
I got my referrals by the grapevine. Mm-hmm.
But you still had a very active social life.
Oh, yes.
Lots of friends.
I had lots of friends. Mm-hmm. I don't have so many
Jewish
friends.
And non-Jewish.
Jewish and non-Jewish. Oh, yes. I've even traveled with some non-Jewish people. There was a Burke family in our neighborhood. When I got had my first car, we went up to Canada, and later on we went up to a Quakerland camp in the Adirondacks. I became very much interested in that group. I've been to Quaker weddings.
Oh, I see. Yes. You mentioned that you were a pacifist during World War I.
Yes.
And that you were involved in the suffragette movement somewhat.
Yes.
Did you ever take an active part in politics?
No.
Except through the League of Women Voters.
Yes.
And you were active in that.
Well, I mean, as a member, you pay your dues.
Yes. Uh-huh. I guess you were so busy with your practice.
Yes. And I'm what you call an inactive council member. I pay my dues. I belong to the Bene of Rith. I pay my dues. You belong to the various medical societies. You pay your dues. Ladies' Hospital Aid Society and that sort of thing. You pay your dues.
Yes, right. Do you observe any religious holidays at the present time?
We are ethical people. Mr. Grimmerman comes from Rabbinum. Do you know what that means? I mean, a family of rabbis. Mm-hmm. He calls them all. Turn it off. I don't belong to a synagogue at present. My husband is a very ethical man, but he's not a religious man. We identify ourselves as Jews. Ethnically, that's what we are. My father's three grandsons have married non-Jewish women. You couldn't meet more refined, intelligent girls than it. And those women have been very fine on both sides of the family. Now, I raised my sister's third child. She came to me as a polio victim when she was 15 years of age. It was through my medical connection that she got to the B.T. Watson home. And she also she was trained for her college board examinations while she was still on the tray. You know what I mean by the tray? It's a movable bed. She did very well, and the rehabilitation board stepped in and gave me a scholarship for her. I insisted that she go to PCW because I had been their doctor for 12 years, from 1924 to 1935. And I knew that college very, very well. I knew she would be accepted and loved. And that was very important to me. I wanted her to have a home to which to come because her family was in Virginia and she was alone up here. I wanted her to bring her friends, to raise my eyes, to entertain her friends in my home and be as a child with a family.
Where is this girl now?
This girl was now a married woman in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania. Her husband, she has two children in college. She's, you never know, she's been a polio victim. Her husband is in geriatrics. He's the executive director of the Philadelphia Geriatric Center, which is one of the largest of its kind in this country, of the Jewish ones. And he is also president of the Jewish group of geriatric people. If he were my son, he could be sweeter and nicer to me. He even sends me airplane tickets.
Is that right?
And we laugh because then I have to find a way to return it.
Did your brother marry and have children?
Yes, he had two children. One is this girl who died of Hodgkin's disease. They now have a chemical, it retards it. And that's Bob's first one. And the second child is Jim, who is in endocrinology research at in Texas. He's married to a non-Jewish girl. They have one child.
You seem to have a close relationship then with most of your nieces and nephews.
Very much so. I'm making an afghan for Marjorie, that's the girl from Lynchburg, and for Marjorie's daughter. The children in the Elkins Park area have both got their afghans. When the children were small, they used to say, I'm a grandma in Newark, and I have Nancy's a grandma in Pittsburgh.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But then I love children. And this little woman in Elkins Park has brought me a great deal of satisfaction and love.
What is her name?
Her name is Evelyn Leibowitz. And she teaches, this is very interesting. As she got better, we used to walk in Frick Woods together. And she majored in art at PCW. At Pennsylvania College for Women, it's now Chatham. And you didn't know that. How long are you in Pittsburgh?
Well, only a few months, so that's
interesting. Well, that's to say, started out at Pennsylvania College for Women, and then later took the name Chatham. Her own children, I wasn't a card player. I wasn't a Saturday nighter, as you call it, back then. She didn't like women's clubs. To her, they were a waste of time. She's not a card player. And she, as they moved around, as he changed jobs, as he didn't use social workers so often enough, she began taking courses, and then she started substitute teaching. First thing you know, she's teaching first grade because she can use her art to teach children.
Would you contrast Pittsburgh today with Pittsburgh yesterday, socially, culturally, politically?
Well, there's more culture here now than when we were. Of course, we did have Carnegie Museum. And one day as I came in to a concert or something, there was an old-time usher there. And I said, how long have you known me? He says, since this building's been built. Because my father used to take us to the museum. We used to go to the Phipps Conservatory. We used to go over to the observatory. We went to the zoo. See, we had a beautiful family life.
Yes, it sounds like it, yes. How do you view Pittsburgh's Jewish life and its place in the general community at the present time?
Oh, well, the Jews are very much more respected now than what they were then.
Even though you felt didn't feel the brunt of prejudice?
No.
You knew that wasn't true for a lot of Jews.
I knew that wasn't true for a lot of Jews. And there were some very lovely country Jews in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But the bulk of the people that we met, who were the club people and the Ruslanders, you couldn't find nicer people. Mrs. Aaron, you couldn't find nicer people. And many of the people who lived on the hill, because, Central High was on the hill. Oh, lovely, lovely people with a sense of ethics and a sense of fair play and such culture. Oh.
How do you view your accomplishments, successes, and failures? They want you to brag about.
I've had a very satisfactory life. Mm-hmm. If I had been desirous of being a great money maker, I am a failure, because I'm definitely middle class. I'm not poverty stricken, but I'm definitely middle class. I'm not a woman of the year, but that doesn't interest me. When I was practicing, I used to say, as long as people are stumbling up my steps, go ahead, break your neck.
You feel that you achieved a certain stature in your own profession?
Yes, in my own way.
What offices did you hold in that profession?
I didn't hold any.
Well, you mentioned that you were, at least when it was off the tape, that you head of the gynecology section, weren't you?
Well, I mean, I had the clinic.
Oh, yeah.
The head of the section was Dr. Goldstein. During World War II, I held retractors until my legs were full of varicose veins. But when the boys came back, I was pushed away from the table.
Well, at that time, you were head of the gynecology?
No, only the clinic.
At the clinic?
Yes.
Okay.
You see, Sam Goldstein and I ran the place during World War II. But elbows, when the elbows begin to come, I didn't give a hang. My story to myself was, as long as people are coming in here, that's the only thing that counts to me. I'm not an ambitious person, if you get that.
I'd like to go into some of those memories from those clinic years, but I don't know whether you feel like talking about them.
Well, the girls, the nurses in the clinic were only too glad that somebody was running it, because...
Were you immensely busy?
Immensely busy. The clinic would start about 8:30 or 9, and sometimes it would close at 1 o'clock. And when I would... This girl that you see here was my office attendant. After I closed my office, she came home with me, and she gives me 3 half-days and runs the house. So,
but did you and Dr. Goldstein by yourselves run the clinic?
We ran the department. He didn't come into the clinic.
Oh, I see.
He was so busy up at the table. And
you did it almost single-handedly, then.
Yes.
Can you estimate the number of people who came in one day on the average?
Well, I mean, until Mr. Bergman put a stop to it, sometimes we had as many as 20 to 25 people. And you can't put a person on the table and take their smears and take their urine and go over them and then talk to them. They're not numbers, they're people. Without giving them some time, you couldn't do anything in less than 20 to 25 minutes. I don't care who you are.
This was just a gynecology clinic.
Yes.
Yes.
Go ahead.
One final question I think we ought to ask. I think the council would be interested in hearing something about your brother, since he was involved in some of the important buildings here in Pittsburgh. Can you talk about him just a little? Some of his achievements as an architect.
Oh, he was a kind of a...
What did he have a part in building?
Well, the...
Designing, rather.
He did the first of the Brown, the Home for the Aged, mm-hmm. the original of that. He did the... Temple big auditorium, Rhoda Scholem, not the temple part, but the mm-hmm. auditorium and the J. Leonard Levy Chapel. He did the Allegheny Heights. That was a project during the Depression that they put up. He did part of one of the projects up at Bedford. He did a South Side project. He was in World War I, and then during the Depression he went to Washington and they began building post offices around the country, and he became foreman of one of those projects.
His family is still here in Pittsburgh.
He has a wife in Pittsburgh.
Yes, that's
what I meant when I was talking. His son is in Texas. Mm-hmm. Mr. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
his body was taken into this hospital where our team was.
Do you have any further questions, Duncan?
Do you have any other information that you would like to cover or add?
Okay, think just a minute.
I substituted in juvenile court on and Dr. Gordon couldn't go there. They were examining girls. After I closed my office, I worked for the state for 10 years as a review physician. That's the permanently impaired people. Have you heard of that project? It's now taken over by the Board of Rehabilitation. Where you have people who have worked in coal mines or on mine, they get what we call a solid lung, you see, black lung disease. Well, they're permanently impaired. People who are over 200% obese, they're permanently impaired. People who have had a stroke are permanently impaired. And they're taken off the relief rolls and given a what I would call it a substance income, but they don't have to have the workers. Now the case has to be written up. First they send them to a clinic or a doctor, then they send them to as many specialists as they need to find out if they're permanently impaired. And a social worker writes up her end of what they can do. The rehabilitation board often has to refuse them training because they know they won't be able to work. And then the chart comes, two charts come before a social worker and a doctor, and I did that work and you review it and then you write a resume and the government picks up one half of the bill, the federal government, and the state picks up the other half of the bill of their maintenance. And I did that. I was past 65. I did that for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Anything else of interest in your career that you'd like to put on the
table? We've done a lot of traveling. Have you ever heard of the Tuck Company, TAUCK? It's one of the better travel companies in America. I've taken nearly all of their trips. Many of them with Mr. Brown.
All around the world, you mean?
No, not this is America.
Oh.
And we've been abroad about 8 times. Now, when we go abroad, we don't try to see the world in 21 days. We'll go to the Scandinavian countries and stay there. Sometimes we go back. We went to Iceland and stayed there 2 weeks.
In Scandinavia, where else?
Oh, we've been to France. We've been down the Rhine. We've been 4 times to Switzerland. See, we had a very fine and full life. And we're glad now because neither I nor Mr. Kerman could do it now.
You did this then in the first 10 years or so after?
In the first 10 years, well.
After you were married.
Well, we did it up to 2 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Oh, really?
We went up to Canada, to Cape Breton, and Halifax. That was another top tour. We flew to New York and then we flew to Halifax. And there we took a, they bring in a bus. They have a guide. Have you taken any of these conductor trips?
No.
Well, they have a guide and a bus driver. You put up at very fine hotels and you get the industrial history and the geographical history and the political history.
So no more camping for
you. No, the camping is out. The camping I haven't done for 10 years. Go ahead.
No, I'm trying to put everything on the tape that we would like to have on. You're traveling,
Let me stop here.